Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book or Juliana also finishes a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. Joining me today, like normal, is Juliana.
Hello, everyone.
And today we're going to be talking about a book that I finished a few weeks ago.
Yes, you did.
And Juliana finished yesterday.
I did, yes.
I listened to the audiobook of Alien Clay by Adrian Tchaikovsky. And the audiobook is 13 hours and 55 minutes. So proper size novel.
Yeah.
Proper good size novel.
I read the Kindle ebook.
Yes.
And
it is 100% long.
It's a long. It's a big book. That's the thing. If you don't see the physical book in front of you.
Yeah.
I sometimes struggle to get an estimate of how big a book is. Because it's as thin as my iPad,
the iPad mini.
And it doesn't change that.
No. And that's one of those things, especially with an audiobook, where suddenly at the end they'll be, and now here's a 1 hour interview with the author, or you know, or now here's a sample of the next book, and you're like, oh, I thought it still had an hour of the book, like, you know, so it can happen in that
way.
Can
be deceiving.
So just talking about the audiobook, it is narrated by Ben Allen. I was kind of disappointed that it wasn't going to be Adrian Tchaikovsky doing the narration, like doing the reading.
Ooh, does he do that?
Yes, we talked about it. He did some of the novellas that I read. I think the Walking to Aldebaran book, I think he narrated that one, and also all of the Service Model that came out last year.
Oh,
as
right.
Well.
Yes.
So yeah, Adrian Tchaikovsky, I've read quite a few of his books now, and we've reviewed quite a few of his books. Children of Time, Children of Ruin, all those, Shards of Earth, Doors of Eden, Elder Race, Service Model, and now, and those as well. Oh, yeah, Children of Memory, of course.
Yes.
All of the Final Architecture series, Shards of Earth, you know, that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, some of these standalone novels, Alien Clay, Service Model. So, yeah, he's an author who keeps putting out more books.
Yes.
I think he published like 3 novels just last year and he's already got some new ones coming out this year. It says Shroud 2025, plus these novellas that I'm talking about as well. So,
yes. Very proficient.
So prolific.
Prolific.
Is a prolific author.
Prolific.
And because we just sort of looked up his Wikipedia page, because I wanted to see these things as well. It says he was trying to get published for 15 years.
Wow.
So I definitely think that's someone who's got 15 years worth of writing ideas.
Mm. But and practice.
Yeah, and practice. And then it's sort of like, well, let me get all these ideas out. And
he certainly found his style and his thing.
Yeah. So good writer, interesting writer, and also kind of varied writer.
Yeah.
It's definitely not like, oh, I'm just going to do some, you know, cozy science fiction and then just keep churning out. He can do that, you know. But what I quite like about him is that a lot of the books, you just don't know what you get going.
Yeah.
You know, don't know what you're going to get when you first start off. But I do like the mix of science fiction, satire, a lot of satire, politics, and there's some big ideas.
Philosophy.
Kind of stuff. Yeah, big ideas.
Yeah.
Not all of his characters are all fantastic, but like, hey, let's get into this book, Alien Clay.
Yeah.
Do you have any like opening statement or anything that you want to say, like one overarching thought before we get into this?
Actually, yes.
All right, go for it.
So this book came out in 2024.
Right, yes.
I read it at the beginning of 2025. And I had a hard time, and not because the book is—it's not the book's fault.
Right.
It's just the time in our times that I'm reading it, that the politics that are currently going on in the world,
yes,
are so, in a way, very different to what's in the book, but in another way, super close to it. In senses that I already started mentally doing like weird prepping thing just in my head. I'm not doing anything actual.
You're becoming
stuff.
A prepper.
In my head. I'm not prepping like food or whatever stuff, but I'm preparing mental ways out, you know, of things. Like, for example, one weird example, and I'm going a bit off course here, but stay with me here. Next month, I'm going to a 4-week rehab thing.
Yeah.
And it would have never occurred in the past, the thought that maybe I should take my passport with me because I'm not home for 4 weeks.
Right.
And just looking at the world development.
You think you might need to get out of Germany or something.
Whatever. You know, this kind of mental preparation I'm doing. Okay, so, but this book goes a bit close to this kind of like, oh my God, what can happen? Also, yeah. To intellectual, scientific thinking people.
Right.
This is not a book talking about a general population
yeah.
that has to fight a fight or whatever. But it is about intelligent people. And I always thought that, you know, if you have a bit of like, if you can think quite right, you will come up with solutions to yeah. problems. But oh my God, this is kind of hard.
Yeah, so your statement is this is a book which is very, 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 very much about politics.
Yeah.
And also, like, the writing style is very much, it's very modern. It's very, like, it's, colloquial style.
Yes.
Like, so the voice of the author or the voice of the main character,
yeah.
like, the way that he's using language is very, very modern.
It is.
So it feels actually, like, more 2024, 2025 than the same story could, this could feel a lot more different. It could feel, like, very, it could feel much more 1984,
yeah,
or it could feel a lot more futuristic. But I think because the voice of the author or the, you know, the protagonist, because
yeah.
everything is happening in first person,
yes.
present tense, I think. So
yeah.
Yes, it just feels more. It just feels more now, and it's not just that it's present tense. It's like just the writing is,
yes.
is very.
And
present.
Even though in this book the premises are completely opposite, like 360 degrees of what's going on in the current world.
Wouldn't say so.
No, but like, you know.
No, let's get into this. Let's
okay,
get into this.
Okay.
Because I want an open statement and now we're doing a deep dive.
Okay.
So.
Do you have an open statement?
Well, not really. I just wanted to, because when you started reading this, you were like a quarter of the way through and you're like, wow, this is a bit much
struggling.
At the moment. So I just wanted you to say that at the start. You know, I thought you might want to talk about that. So here's the thing. The world. This all happens on a different world called Kiln.
Yes.
And they're like, why is it called Kiln? But anyway, they're on the way to Kiln.
Yeah.
Already the clay and kiln, you know, it's been those things are linking up already. But back on Earth, there's a worldwide government political system, like totalitarian, kind of collectivist but fascist kind of system called the Mandate.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed the name the Mandate
yes.
for a political system.
Yes.
Because
it makes a lot of sense.
Well, yeah, it's not just making a lot of sense, but like so many times I get really annoyed by science fiction authors who don't put in the work to come up with a name for the political entity which is in charge of something.
Yeah.
So it's the Commonwealth or the, you know, whatever it's going to be, like all of these different kind of things. And you're like, yeah, but it's the Commonwealth of what? Or it's the, you know, it's the whatever the empire is or whatever. It's always just the empire.
The empire.
Or the
generic.
The Commonwealth, the whatever. But the Mandate has got such great baggage to it, which just sort of like, you know, generic civilization or generic political unit of whatever by being the, I don't know, the... I normally have a whole list of these in my head that I can reel off, if you know what I mean. Like the Confederation, the Civilization, all these different kind of things.
Yeah. The polity.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So like, what is it?
Yeah.
You know, but the Mandate is so great because it is a kind of political science sociology kind of term. Like if you have a mandate to lead, you have a political mandate, which means
somebody
that,
gave it to you.
Yes, but that means it's, but generally the mandate is from like elections.
Yeah.
So, and this is a very British thing that they say, which is like, oh, we'll have a mandate to lead, we'll have a mandate. So in other words, they got a majority of the votes.
Mm-hmm.
Although in the UK it's normally like a
in
plurality.
In Germany it's quite similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you say, oh, now we've got the mandate. And, and again, with the proportional representation, you actually, one party who gets the biggest number or the largest number of votes or seats or whatever it is, then gets like the mandate to, or the authority to form the government and do what they want, even if they don't have a majority of the vote.
Yeah.
And so the idea that, you can claim a mandate without having a majority of the votes and then push through dumb political stuff, even though only, you know, 33% of people voted for Brexit. You're like, now we have a mandate. And you're like, no, but, well, you know, and also you get like the mandate of heaven, which is like, I think the, you know, that goes back to the divine right of kings, or the, I think, although the mandate of heaven, I think, is a Chinese thing where they're like, oh, we got to come up with it. All right. So we don't have a mandate, but like of democracy mandate of, So I've just really loved the idea. Like, just the name, The Mandate, is such a great name for a like a totalitarian kind of fascist, but also kind of like pretending to be communist or collectivist or whatever it is. You know, like, everything's for the greater good. It's like, for the greater good of what?
Yeah.
Exactly.
And what I like about this as well, in the addition to The Mandate, is that it's scientific orthodoxy.
Yes. I was going to come to that, but yes.
And that, in my head, is just brilliant.
Yes. So, and this is what you're saying, sort of like, oh, what's the it's not that connected to modern times, but I actually do think there is at the moment, with these like tech billionaires and tech bros getting into like becoming more and more powerful. There's a lot of what's going on, which is like, it's not so much scientific, but it's like this techno optimism, and now like political protests of like against like Elon Musk or whatever, the symbols of Elon Musk is now like Tesla and SpaceX. And so there's like this technological kind of like backing to what makes somebody clever. In this book, it's more scientific, but there's definitely they're playing kind of in the same space there.
Yeah.
Or Adrian Tchaikovsky is kind of like making some comments there. It's just sort of like, just because someone's clever in one field, or just because you've got like some scientific ideas here, doesn't mean that that's the correct way of politics, or the correct way of philosophy, or the correct way of other things there as well.
I think the comment on here is that no matter what totalitarian system you put up, if it is a scientific totalitarianism, it's still gonna be bad. Anything that is going in that direction, no matter if it's technology or science in this case, is gonna be bad. And I want to read something.
Oh, you're gonna read something
that I just read the Wikipedia page for authoritarianism.
Yeah.
And one section says, prior to 2000, like it's now our current world, dictatorships typically began with a coup and replaced a pre-existing authoritarian regime. Since 2000, dictatorships are most likely to begin through democratic backsliding, whereby a democratically elected leader established an authoritarian regime.
Yeah.
I've had a big struggle with this word today. So, and I think that is kind of really describing it.
But what's key to this scientific orthodoxy is almost like an oxymoron. It's a contradiction in terms.
Yeah.
In that science is a process of gaining new knowledge and disproving old knowledge.
Yeah.
So as soon as you've got an orthodoxy, there can't be that kind of like paradigm shift. Yeah. You know, it's like enforcing no paradigm shifts in the future.
Yeah.
And I think that is a great foundation of a totalitarian, authoritarian government or ruling system. Yeah. Again, we never actually see it from the inside because it all happens on a different planet than Earth. So we only have like, you know, him mentioning what happened back on Earth and what it was like. But I do think that a lot of these things, you do need that like contradictory idea at the center of authoritarianism and, you know, totalitarianism, like in fascism and things, is that it actually kind of requires something which has an orthodoxy, but is actually almost like it's so kind of like pointless or obviously untrue or not correct. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's going all this kind of thinking is like if you look at the 1984 and they have this idea that at the heart of it there isn't actually anything there.
No.
It's just a trick that to be able to exist in the system, you have to accept that 2 + 2 = 5. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think Adrian Tchaikovsky is grappling with in this novel, is that there is a system where 2 by 2, 2 plus 2 must equal five. And it's about, this is a story not about someone who works in the Ministry of Truth trying to like go, oh, no, there's these two contradictions. And if everybody just knew about this contradiction, there would be an uprising and everybody would, you know, learn their lesson and stuff. And it's like, no, that is the point. The point is that enough people just go, oh, right, there's scientific orthodoxy. Okay. Yeah. You know, there's whatever the core is, you know, again, we've been talking about like Nazis, National Socialism. You're like, it's socialism, but it's sort of like, well, yeah, it's socialism, but it isn't socialism for the people. It's socialism for the government and the country and the country or whatever it is, you know, that, that ruling class or ruling kind of system.
Yeah.
But that is, has to be that there has to be a fundamental contradictory thing for you to kind of like hang fascism and totalitarianism and authoritarianism off of. And you've seen that in communism, fascism, and all these different kind of isms.
Yeah. And so in this book, and this is kind of like what the contradiction is that science, if you do science in a actual, like in the way it is intended, in the rigorous scientific way, there is an infinite openness.
Yeah.
You have to be infinitely open to the results.
Yeah.
You can't go do a scientific experiment thinking you want a certain outcome.
Yeah.
You have a hypothesis of an outcome.
Yeah, and you're going to try and prove it or disprove it.
Exactly. Yeah. But you have to be as open to what it presents to you.
Yeah.
In comparison to like, okay, this has to be it. And this is the orthodoxy in that weird construct there, that our protagonist tries to have that openness, like that open mind towards everything, and that is then being seen as the kind of like the people with free speech who you know, that's the kind of then free speech doesn't freedom doesn't count for everybody. It's only counts for the you know, the mandate side.
Yeah.
They have a free speech, whatever.
But no, but even the people within the mandate don't have a free speech because they can't go against the orthodoxy. All right, so let's move on to this next part.
Okay.
Like, that's just kind of like the political backdrop.
Yes.
The next thing that you do is arrive on a planet, and every time that I've read a science fiction book where people go down to a planet and they're not wearing, like, they like, and now let's take off the helmet or let's take off the mask. And you're like, what are you doing? Exposing yourself to, you know, you've seen it in The Sparrow, you see it. And you have to just go like, oh no, we can't tell the story where everybody has to be completely isolated from the rest of the world, even though that is actually what we would do as scientists. You know, we'd actually want to be everything sterilized, everything isolated, because you wouldn't
separated
want to.
Separated, like very rigorously.
And that has been done in science fiction, like Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson, where they're like, ah, shit. Like there can be no interaction here between our, you know, whatever life is here on the, in human terms and outside.
Yeah.
But in so many times I'm like, well, why did they take off the helmet? Yeah. Like, why did they lick the thing? Like, why? And that's one of those core science fiction tropes of you arrive on the alien planet and immediately go, oh, the air is safe. Oh, the air is breathable. Take off your helmet and then be ready to infected by Prometheus alien, you know, xenomorphs or whatever it's going to be.
Yeah. However, it's always the thing I always see or read and like groan.
Yeah, you're probably right. However, what I really like about this book is that Adrian Tchaikovsky has gone, right, well, how do I do that? Like, why would it make sense for people to be lax about the, you know, the quarantining and lax about the security and lax about the
decontamination,
that's the kind of thing. Mm. And the way that he does it is that, oh, actually, the scientists aren't just scientists on a planet. They're not a colony, it's not a scientific outpost, or it's not just that. It's, oh, what's this one?
See, the first two notes obviously were so important to me that I highlighted it twice.
Yes. So the idea being is that these are, because it's a penal colony or it's a prison planet, but also a scientific, you know, exploration or an academic outpost. Yes, there's this thing called acceptable wastage, which means that you can do the science fiction trope of let's go out and experience what the nature is like out there. But we don't get to wear face masks and helmets all the time. And we don't get to, you know, every time the expedition comes back. Excursions, that's it. Mm-hmm. Like, every time the excursions comes back, they only get decontaminated once every 4 days. And you're like, oh, we should be getting decontaminated every day. And so I'm like, ah, well, we don't have the money and resource to do that.
Penalty.
And then there is some acceptable wastage. And the acceptable wastage is the punishment. That is the punishment for being a political dissident. Yes.
Except I just gave my
I see.
iPad
yes,
to
but
to
it
Luke
scrolled
because...
down and you said the first two times.
Right.
And the top one was off scrolled off the top.
Okay.
So I was wondering what the second one was that you
so
wanted
I
to show.
So I highlighted it.
Yeah, you
that,
highlighted it twice.
That term
acceptable
twice.
Wastage.
Yes.
Okay. So
and that's the humans. That's the scientists and the humans that are being sent there are called acceptable wastage.
No, they're being sent there and if they die,
that is
acceptable wastage.
Yes.
So that's good fun. The next level of this clever setup for this is the idea being that it's academics there.
Mm-hmm.
So Professor Artaon Dardev, mm-hmm. or Dagdev, if you don't know how to pronounce his name properly.
Dardev
is a professor, and back on Earth, he's a pretty good professor, like pretty well done. And he gets sent to Kiln. Mm. They put him on a spaceship and like accelerate him out there, and they decelerate in the atmosphere, and you can burn up if it doesn't go right.
I don't care about the people.
But as long as 50% of the scientists arrive, get down to the planet and get picked up, that's fine. You know, they go and pick them up, get them back there. And so immediately one of his companions or someone he knew burns up in the atmosphere right at the start of the book. That's how it opens, really, by going, I wake up and think other people are burning up in the atmosphere around me, but my little cocoon makes it down.
This is one of the reasons why I had such a hard time actually getting into it, because it starts really grim.
But he has been sent. He has been sent there as a political dissident, but only because some of his thoughts or some of his writings were like slightly too close, like slightly too far away from the scientific orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
But he's actually been working as a bit much more in-depth dissident, actually being a revolutionary or whatever.
Yeah, trying to organize.
But the mandate didn't know that. But he got sent out for a lesser crime. So right away you get this kind of thing. He arrives there, and other people who are with him have also been sent there, some of them a few months earlier, and they don't know, like they think he was the snitch and things. So you get this stuff. But what's the fun part of this is that there is a mixture of academic politics and real politics.
Yeah.
And there's this fantastic quote or this I made a note of it from Wikipedia, Sayers' Law. Sayers' Law, the idea, and it comes
like
from
Trump, like from Tom Sawyer.
No, just a person.
Differently spelled.
Sayre.
Oh, okay.
Sayer. I don't know.
Okay.
And it's based on the idea that academic politics is the most vicious and bitter form of politics because
Absolutely.
The stakes are so low. And the other, there's different formulations of it. But in any dispute, the intensity of feeling is inversely proportional to the value of the issues at stake. And adds, that is why academic politics are so bitter. So what I love about this book, especially like that first pretty much like the first half of the book, is the idea of academic politics of like, who is the lead researcher? Who gets to be the person to call the shots? You know, who is talking with the dean and who is also like the prison, like the guy running the prison is also in charge of the research. And then you get different places. Oh, I want to be like promoted up here. I'm going to get tenure. I'm going to do all of this kind of stuff. All of the academic politics of who gets the name on the papers and who gets credit and all of these other kind of bits and pieces is against a backdrop of actual real politics, which is also against the backdrop of this isn't just an academic institution, it's also a prison camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the interplay between the academic politics is the most vicious and bitter form of politics because the stakes are so low. But how about let's get that vicious and bitter form of politics, but don't have the stakes really low. Mm-hmm. Have the stakes literally be life and death.
Yes.
Combined with actual revolutionary politics and counter-revolutionary politics and anti-counter-revolutionary politics, all this different kind of stuff going on. So the academic stakes are normally very low, but let's make them even higher. But then also have the actual final question that needs solving by this academic dispute be going either for or trying to support or go against the scientific orthodoxy, which is the foundation of the whole mandate. So you've got like these three levels of like, okay, what level of bitter and vicious form of politics are we doing here? Mm-hmm. Are we doing like the academic level? Are we doing the, you know, prison politics level? Are we doing the, you know, totalitarian level? I guess there's one extra bit as well. And all of those play into what is at the core of the mandate and their scientific, orthodoxy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, for me, this is also, again, one of those parts why it hits so close to
because you work at a university.
Not only that, I have experienced this kind of academic politics twice in my life now. Once as a student.
Yeah.
So I was just like the pawn among the politics that was going on. I had no say in it at all, but I was literally rubbed, my personal being, between two faculties who were like one was headed by a very, like, I don't know, a dominant small man who had his ideas and that went against the others. And so they didn't care about the students that were being literally destroyed in between that. But it was so important to their politics.
Yes.
That I experienced it firsthand on me, on my own personal
journey.
Were
you the acceptable wastage?
Kind of. Yeah, kind of. Like, we were kind of treated that way. And then the second time in my life that I experienced that was then starting to work in academia as just an employee, as staff member. So again, have no say in anything, but experienced like personally in my life what that means. And now in my job, I am again a pawn between the politics of the professors, the deans, the presidents, the chancellors. And it's everything that you just said is absolutely true.
Now, just imagine,
devastating.
Imagine if you were doing all of that, and while navigating all of that, if you took the wrong step, you're sent on excursions. In other words, you're sent out without decontamination.
Exactly,
to find
and this is why
stuff.
I had such a hard time, and why in my brain I am preparing, because literally the government can decide what is acceptable in academia at any given moment, as you can see in the US, where it's just going batshit at the moment. But like,
I don't see because I'm not following.
But it is happening. It is pretty, pretty crazy. And so, when you think of academia, you think of it as something like enlightened and clever and intelligent people.
Nope. It's just an institution that can be
just kindergarten all the way down. People are vicious. People are selfish. People are narcissistic. People are weird and emotional. And especially, and here it comes, the men are crazy, emotional and weird.
It's almost as though humans are the problems rather than
that's what it comes down to.
So let's move on to the next thing in the book, which is, because we still haven't even got to the story yet.
I know. this is all important.
And then the next thing is, of course, all the alien stuff. So all of that stuff is there, and then of course the interplay between the aliens, which are actually, you know, collective and communist and whatever, you know. It's all about, you know, the life there is all about how well you can cooperate with other life rather than how well, like, so inside the prison / scientific university outpost is, it's all about not cooperating. It's all about battling each other. And then outside, all of the life there is about cooperating with each other. And I think there's a line which is like, it's not survival of the fittest by how many other things you can kill and eat and outcompete. It's survival of the most cooperative by how many other things you can help out. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're, I mean, there's a little bit about evolution. Like, so if you're really, really good, like your mitochondrial DNA or whatever it is, and you're like the power plant of the inside of the cells, it's like, great, go for it. Like, everybody wants that. Very, very successful.
Yeah. And this part of the book, I always really, really appreciate Adrian Tchaikovsky's writing.
Yeah.
Because if you have read any other books of his, the thing I love most about his books and writing and stuff is when he writes about aliens.
Yeah, the biology.
Because he can just do it so, so well.
Very good, very
because
good.
Because it is just feels, it's not just like a person that sat there like, oh, okay, how could the alien look like? Oh, like green mannequins. You know,
yeah.
He has the creativity of the biology. I want to just read this part of the sentence because that's kind of like what this book is like speckled with. We walk on semi-permeable mats of interlaced lichenous fronds.
Yeah.
Like, these words are put together, but you have immediately an idea what it is.
Yeah.
Like, how it feels.
What your place is, yeah. So, very good stuff there with the alien stuff. And it's a bit like Southern Reach. It's a bit Jeff Vandermeer Annihilation kind of stuff.
Yes.
That everything outside is a bit weird and not quite there. And you have to give names to everything. But the names that you're giving to them, they're not actually, you know, elephants. But it's just like the biggest creature.
It looks like something.
You know,
like
whatever
that.
It is.
And I want to point out that all that stuff that you're now talking about only starts about three quarters into the book.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's there at the start, but it's only once until Anton Dardev starts going on to the excursions where you actually meet it face to face. You've had hints at it, you've had horror before, but now it's sort of like, yes, come face to face with the horror.
So then, again,
don't want to get into too many spoilers, but it's like quite an obvious, it's kind of obvious where it's going, I think, where the book is going, especially it's very well foreshadowed. Mm-hmm. Although the foreshadowing is a bit weird because it's all in present tense. So it's sort of like, how do you do foreshadowing in present tense? It kind of breaks your brain a bit. But I do think that is a function of actually what happens later in the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit stories of your life and others in this way. I don't think it is, but I am just saying that there's ways to do present tense, which I think is that can work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird. And I found it weird to listen to somebody in present tense saying, I'll tell you that later.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, but it's always now, isn't it? Or whatever. So that's a tricky thing. So finally, yes, my final note is the idea of like, you are the system. And I think this is a really interesting thought about our current political systems.
Mm-hmm.
And we were watching some stuff about a SpaceX launch.
Yeah.
Yesterday,
yes.
Or 2 days, was it yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday.
Anyway, watching
yesterday.
Some stuff like, why did the rocket explode? And I was watching some YouTube videos about that. And you were like, I find it really hard to enjoy rocket stuff when it's so much about SpaceX, because SpaceX is so much to do with Elon Musk's personality SpaceX and Tesla are like entwined with Elon Musk and his personality. And he is so objectionable at the time that you find that rubbing off on your enjoyment of sitting on the couch next to me and watching a video about why did a rocket explode. And I totally understand that.
Yeah.
However, I think that this book is one of the final, one of the political takeaways from this is like everybody exists within the system.
Yes.
And this is a science fiction book where at the end, people can kind of choose which system they exist within.
Yeah.
But also they can't really, you can't choose what it is.
Yeah.
Because so much of it is like, do I exist within this system or do I not exist anymore? Because there isn't any way, if it's like a worldwide mandate,
mm-hmm.
or in this case, a worldwide biology system,
mm-hmm.
you have to fit yourself to the system.
Yeah.
And that's what this book is about. It's sort of like saying, are you going to fit yourself into the political system, or are you going to fit yourself into, you know, whatever philosophical or biological system that there is? There isn't a choice not to be part of the system. And even if you are rebelling against it, even if you're working against the system, even if you're trying to protest the system, there is no way to do that outside of the system.
Yeah.
The system is the world.
Yeah.
Our political system at the moment is all of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tricky thing where, you know, and I mentioned to you before when I was like, yeah, but like everything that is like that's made in China is propping up a, you know, totalitarian regime there.
Yeah.
They have pretty much a, you know, dictatorship, whatever kind of thing. You know, it's called communism, but it isn't, you know, it doesn't need to be like it. That's one of the things of the Chinese system. That's one of the core contradictions at the heart of it.
Yeah.
Is that it's meant to be a communist government. You know, it's a communist party, the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, but it is aggressively hyper capitalistic mm-hmm. and commercial and mm-hmm. all of that kind of stuff at the same time.
Yeah.
And the economic output of China is what the world runs on.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it doesn't matter it's like you can't exist in the world and not buy things that are made in China and contribute to the Chinese economy.
Yeah.
It's like it's very difficult to exist in the modern world and to live a normal life and not order things from Amazon. And then you're going, yeah. Oh, but you know, that's yeah. owned by Jeff Bezos, and Jeff Bezos didn't not endorse Trump or like commanded the news. You know, it's all messy, but yes. it's impossible mm-hmm. to exist outside of the system.
Yeah.
Because you're either in the system, part of the system, you can be protesting the system, you can be working against the system,
yeah.
but by you being there, you are, the system just exists.
Yes.
And you have to find your own way to reconcile that. You know, the whole, there is no, you know, under capitalism, there's no ethical consumption or no ethical consumption under capitalism. But it doesn't mean that you must never consume anything.
Yeah.
It just means that you can acknowledge that you're in a system which is that you can't get out of the system. So you have to find your place in the system. And I think that's what one of the big struggles by Anton Dardev and Adrian Tchaikovsky in this book is that it can be huge. You can be as satirical as you like,
yeah.
and you can be narcissism as small differences, and you can be what is it? Academic politics is the most vicious and bitter form of. You can have jokes about all of that and be entertaining and do all that writing about it. But I think the core thing that this book is struggling with is sort of like you're going to be part of a system, and you can there might be conflicting systems, but you have to be part of it. There is
yeah.
no man is an island, and this is like this book, I think one of the main messages is sort of saying it is like showing the human way of doing that, which is like the political institutions and the prisons and the you know, acceptable wastage and the academics and all of that kind of stuff, contrasted to a biological system which is not intentional, doesn't have intelligent actors in it.
Yeah.
But you still have the same system. There is still a tyranny there, and there is still a price to pay to be within it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have two takeaways from this book.
Yeah.
One of them is the way that it's portraying what they are calling here the sub-commissions. So the sub-commissions,
mm.
where people are trying to protest and to be the dissidents within
yes.
the system. And it works to a certain point when you can't, up until when you can't be sure that everybody is going to act in a certain way.
Yeah.
And then we come to this, like, everybody...
It's literally a prisoner's dilemma.
Yes, everybody is
yeah.
on their own.
Yeah.
And even if you find a group of people and you all agree on something and you say, okay, let's do this. We have to sacrifice ourselves to the greater
yeah.
good. And now I'm reading a quote, and I don't think I spoil anything here with it. But this is the great writing in this book. What's the point in taking the bullet if the person behind you in the charge loses heart, dithers, runs away? You may as well have stayed at home. You only have one life after all. It can be very hard to know when to throw it away.
Yeah.
So there's no point in taking a bullet if then you sacrifice yourself and everybody goes home and says, yeah, the mandate is great. Okay,
yeah.
What did you do that for? So it is, in this book, it becomes so apparent how difficult it is to organize.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it doesn't matter how intelligent you are, how much resources you have, and how many people you can convince by being charismatic or organized. It's going to not work.
Yeah. Well, it's not that it's going to not work. It's that this is a book about how difficult any of that is.
Yeah.
And like you said at the start, it's almost impossible now for these dictatorships to rise up from like a strongman coming in or a political coup. That's actually too simple for the modern world.
Yeah.
It's because it like that doesn't cut it, if you know what I mean. So it actually, in this way, this book is talking about like even the most intelligent people, that's now too difficult. You actually have to do regulatory capture, you've got to do political capture, you've got to do economic capture, you've got to get there from the inside. And again, I think that's talking about the real world. And if we want to bring it back to Elon Musk again, it's sort of like it's too, like, Donald Trump didn't get to continue being president by like storming the Capitol on January 6th.
No.
That didn't work. It didn't work. No. There's actually all of the current
institutions. We have put in place ways to avoid that. Yeah.
We have police and courts and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But then, like the way that he gets back is, you know, Elon Musk signs up, buys Twitter, and then signs up lots of Amish people to vote for him or whatever, you know, whatever in Pennsylvania, whatever the plans
they
were.
They get it through democracy through the democratic process from the inside.
Yeah, if that feels so bad, but it's one of those things that like, you can't not be part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
You can't not vote and get your way.
Mm-hmm.
You can't tell people not to vote and get your way.
Yeah.
Now, it's that kind of like capture of institutions. And that's definitely what's happened in America, is that all of these institutions are being have been captured by one political party in a way which many, many other political systems around the world, the actual institutions are either specifically not partisan in that way or can't be partisan. Mm-hmm. Or if they do become partisan, you know, there's rules in place, you know, to stop that happening. Whereas in America, there is no rules in place to stop anything from becoming 100% partisan.
Yeah.
And it's tricky when the media becomes partisan and there's no rules against it, and technology becomes partisan and the courts become partisan and the Supreme Court becomes partisan and all, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's just nothing there anymore.
Yeah.
And but again, I do think Alien Clay confronts all these issues, but I think the storytelling of, like, especially in that last third of the book, it does, I think it's kind of like becomes, I would say that the plot becomes more simplistic as the political wrangling becomes more desperate.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, I think this has got a lot in common with 1984, again, the political system and the, you know, the doublethink and the correct, you know, orthodoxy and all that other kind of stuff. But I think what's really interesting is the ending of this is very ambiguous.
Yeah.
And 1984 ends with Winston Smith looking at Big Brother as the bombs come down and saying, you know, I love him or whatever it is. It's very ambiguous. And this ends, and in some ways you're like, triumph. And then the other ways you're thinking, you know, what's even the system here?
Yeah. I think there's two things to the other end of the message. So that was the you know, the dissident and the political uprising kind of side of this book.
Yeah.
The other end, and this is, I have two more remarks on this, is you have to give yourself up for a drastically other sort of totalitarianism.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And
it's ambiguous. Like, what's the better system?
What I appreciate about this book is, like, do you remember when in previous books we have talked about authors putting in the token non-binary trans or black people, or, you know, the diversity hire for the book?
Yeah, the box ticking
Ticking things that is really happening in books that you can see, like, where people just added, okay, we need to put in, like, it doesn't, and it's not coherent because it's not coming from a substantial, it's not part of the idea of the book. It's added in because it needed to tick the box.
Because it was written in 2023, yeah.
In this book, I feel this is all the characters, for me, feel genuinely important to everything in the book.
Right.
Especially the end part, where we literally have a disabled person and we have a non-binary person that are not being put in there for because they have to. They are human beings in the same sphere, in the same position as everybody else. And it's not like they are there for their particular purpose. Yeah. They are just people in the same situation. And the end part really shows the empathy that we need to embrace of thinking if we are privileged white people of like in any way privileged, we need to start thinking ourselves into other people. And that's what happens.
Yeah.
You have to think, how does this person experience this situation?
Yeah.
And the other totalitarianism on this planet, on Kiln,
yeah,
gives everybody that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I want to, read this. I don't know.
I don't think the Kiln biology is totalitarianism. It isn't, but it is collectivist. Kind of communist collectivist kind of thing.
Yes.
It's like the opposite of that, but it's still a system. Yeah.
But to me,
do you want to read something?
I don't think it's worth. I mean, I highlighted things because I think they are good and important to my enjoyment of the book, which I can show you later, but I don't think it's I need to read it out. However, I just want to point out that this book is, and this is why I wanted to look up again what Adrian Tchaikovsky's background is, and everything makes so much sense. And this book feels very much like the thorough creative output of a guy who studied zoology and
zoology and psychology.
And worked as a lawyer.
Yeah.
This represents it all. Like there's things from all of his things in it.
And that's the thing. Yeah. This is someone, I think Adrian Tchaikovsky is like the best author at the moment because he, in all of these books, all of his books and all of his things have enough ideas to get you through. Like they've got, there's so much going on there because he's drawing from, you know, politics, academia,
biology,
alien, and also very well read in science fiction. I've mentioned this before that it's great to be able to have someone who's like playing with the tropes or playing with the space, and that he's come up with this idea of combining academia with prison camp with biological research with totalitarian politics. It's like, it's got this like four to five things, let's say, going on at once in a novel. And it's a bit of a juggle. And actually, I think because there's so much going on, I thought the story, I was like, is this story weak? Or if there was more story, would it just be too much? And so I do think the story is not weak, but it's like, I got through to the end of the book and I was like, there should be another big twist here. Or there should be another big thing or going a different direction or another adventure or more. And then I was like, no, actually, we've got like four different ideas going on here.
Yes.
And that he gets any plot at all to resolve all four of them at once.
Yeah.
I think is just he could have gone for a bigger plot or more, but then I think the book would have to be like twice the length or whatever.
And it is already a chunky book.
It's already a chunky book.
And the beginning
with a plot which is based much more around the characters and ideas than it is around a big, you know, big revelation. Because like there's nothing that happens in the book where you go, wow, I didn't see that coming. But what does happen pays off everything.
And they don't go very far. Nothing in the book really goes anywhere. It stays within a certain perimeter.
Yeah, because it's about like personal interpersonal politics, which is also about prison camp politics, which is also about academic politics, which is also about totalitarian actual government politics.
And interhuman relationships and all of that that comes along with hierarchy. And we haven't even talked about the different factions of camp thing. What I wanted to say, at the beginning, I had a hard time because it is a lot of like torture, horror, and
It's a bit brutal at places.
It's brutal at the beginning, so it took me a while to get through all that, and then it adds and it makes sense. But it is violent, so I'm very sensitive to this kind of stuff. But it has to be there to show the whole picture of everything, and so I really, really appreciated this book, and it's kind of eye-opening in the way that it doesn't really matter what I'm preparing in my head, because in the end, I can't do anything. I either then have to go with the system, or I have to live out in the woods by myself with just foraging stuff.
But weirdly
that is
enough,
the other, no, that is the other option that I
no,
have.
No, but also that's part of the system. I know that's
yes.
weird to say.
I mean, yes, in a way, yeah. And so there's not really a way out. So I can just enjoy myself right now. And
well, it's not about enjoying yourself. It's about again, I don't know, it's weird to say this, but like this is not what the book's about. But
no.
if you have to exist within the system, all you have to do is, like, I know it's weird to say this, but you just got to make the lives of other people around you, the people that you come in contact to, with better and more
yes.
pleasant, and
be empathetic to people.
Yeah, and it's such a like crass ways of like, oh, all you need to do is make a difference in the world and make other, like, just do your small part to make
yeah.
everybody's life a bit better.
Yeah.
But like,
that's true.
I can't vote in elections outside of Germany now. You know, like
no.
there's nothing I can do.
We can't do anything about American
yeah.
politics. Like, literally.
Yeah.
And, except that we observe.
And our own local politics and stuff. I mean, there is, like, again, it's a tricky balance, but now we live in an AFD. We live in the
state that majority
yeah.
of people voted
yeah.
for that, even though that the party doesn't represent anything for the people.
No.
But they are just, yeah. It's just,
anyway, not to get too much into that, but I'm just saying that, like,
yeah.
where you can find meaning is
yeah.
by living your life to make things, make the world and the people that you come into contact with and the people who see you and interact with you and all that
yeah.
kind of stuff. All your job is to just do the best you can in that way.
Yeah.
Again, there are other ways to, you know, do political action,
yeah.
but in your life, you can't put your happiness and fulfillment on what the politics is like in America at the moment.
Yes.
Or even what the politics is like in Germany.
Yeah.
yeah, the local
and,
politics.
And at the moment, literally wherever you live, it doesn't
yeah.
matter where you live. But and for me particularly, it is a question of how I need to take care of myself. I need to have my own energy reserves that
yeah,
aren't
yeah.
huge. So, but what I can do is I can sing. I can sing for people.
Yeah.
You can juggle for people, make them smile and have a happy time. And you can do the small things for people around you. Yeah, as you said.
I'm saying you should do more. I mean, you can do as much as you can politically. What
yeah.
I'm saying is you can't, I don't think it's healthy to have your sense of identity and happiness
yeah.
and accomplishment wrapped up in political struggles that you can't, that like aren't under your control.
Yeah.
You should try to influence them, but that shouldn't be, I don't think it's help. I mean, for me, let me put it this way. Let's bring it back to me and you,
yeah.
Because we know each other and live together. The idea being that we can't allow ourselves of sense of self and happiness be reliant on political outcomes which aren't under our control.
Yeah.
And so while we can help in those ways and we can do what we can and we can vote how we can and all these other kind of things,
yeah.
that can't be the basis of personal fulfillment and happiness.
Yeah.
Personal fulfillment and happiness comes with things that you can control. And what you can control is how much you improve the lives of other people around you.
Yes.
That is under your control.
Yeah.
So that's why I'd say work on that, which is, again, nothing to do with the book.
No,
I'm
but
just
that's
saying
definitely
that, like,
something that you can take out of the book. Like, the
yeah.
book gives you so much thought on your own
yeah.
interaction with your surroundings and the environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really, really, really appreciated this book.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's good.
So
I mean, do you have anything to say about the story or the characters or the writing or anything? Because we just cut straight to the big ideas in this book and because normally we talk about, like, oh, this happens or that happens and characters and, but here we just went straight to the, not even the themes. Well, yeah, we went straight to the themes and concepts and the ideas behind the book rather than even what's in the book.
Regarding the character, the selection of characters, I think there's not a lot to say about it
no.
from my side, because it is just a healthy, normal mix of people. Like, as I said before, there is no tokenism going on here. There's just a certain selection of people. There's like
yeah.
there's professors, there's doctors, there's women, there's disabled people, there's like binary people, but and it's just
non-binary people
and non-binary
yeah.
and binary, of course, and And there's just no particular focus on, oh, this person has to be that way to show off something certain, like a certain trope. We need to like have this person so they can play off their like meaning. And this is it. This it's just it's just a mix of people.
Yeah.
And it's intelligent women and it's stupid guys and stupid women and intelligent guys. And it's like everything in this, there's nothing, like the characters aren't always likable. Yeah, of course.
Of course
they're not.
I don't think the main character's likable. I think he's interesting and fun. And
he's a professor and he's being told many times and he knows. He's very self-reflective about it.
No, I am a coward. Like, I'm going to be a coward. I'm going to be a coward. And then he does stuff which isn't cowardly.
Yes.
And I'm like, how much are you telling us? Because it's like in first person. Mm. How much are you telling yourself that you're a coward and that you're not going to do something as like a defense mechanism, but actually I think that's the interesting thing about the main character, is that he's unreliable about, like, he thinks he's got more foibles, or he's calling himself more unreliable than he actually is. He's actually quite a reliable character, even though he's calling himself a coward all the time, which I think is a fun play thing.
It is.
All right then, so let's wrap it up.
Yeah.
You're gonna give this book a rating. What are you gonna give it?
5 stars.
It's a 5-star book for you.
Yeah.
Okay. I think for me, it's not a 5-star book, but let's give it 4.5 stars, a combined rating of like 4.5 stars.
Okay.
Is that all right?
If we combine 4.5 and 5, that comes.
No. I would have given this book 4 stars.
Oh, 4 stars. Okay.
I think there is a lot to think about this book, and we've talked about the stuff that I really enjoy.
Yeah.
But I do think that it is a bit, not too trivial, but it's a bit whimsical for the subject matter, and it's very, and I think this is going to be dated very 2024.
Okay.
It's very much the ironic detachment kind of stuff, which is, you know, very, you know, tall wave squeakcore of, well, that happened, you know, there's a lot of that.
Okay.
I'm just saying that the language is like very now, which is great, but also I like my 5-star books to make me cry. This book makes me think and it makes me appreciate, but I never had an emotional the right kind of emotional connection to the book, which I like for a 5-star book.
Okay.
And again, the ideas are kind of outweighing the story, and I like there to be a better balance of story with ideas. And this is almost, I mean, I like an ideas-driven fiction and biology and politics and all the other kind of stuff. I like that. But in the end, I did feel not let down, but like I did feel the story was, one quarter of the way through the book, I could kind of see where this is going. And it played out kind of how I expected without enough surprises. Not to say that it's bad. I'm just saying that I found this book very entertaining, really fun, interesting, also horrific in the right ways and interesting, but it never grabbed me on this like emotional core that I want books to grab me on.
Okay.
Beyond just intellectual and, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G kind of stuff.
I like
A, B, C, D, E, F, blah, 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 G, whatever. I don't know.
What?
I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't know what the thing is. What's the French word for I don't know what it's called? Anyway, I'm making a joke. Je ne sais quoi.
There's a je ne sais quoi missing.
Whatever the word for the thing that's missing is missing.
Okay.
That I don't know what other authors put into their books to make me cry.
Yes.
Or for them to impact me in a way which changes how my brain works or changes how my life works.
Yeah.
And authors who give me 5-star books make me see science fiction in a new way, or see my life in a new way, or see a big idea in a new way, at the same time as having characters that go through things strong enough to make me cry. This book didn't get there for me.
I understand why. And I think I'm a little bit closer to it because of my academic, like literally, like I'm right in the grit and everything right there.
Yeah.
So I think it gave me a little bit more in that direction because of my personal experiences.
Yeah, no, I get it.
It also didn't make me cry. It's more of an intellectual.
Yeah, no, and that's fine. But it's
exercise.
Not that it, well, I say I'm using it makes me cry as a shortcut to say, can something move me It doesn't have to move me to tears.
Yeah.
But it has to move me in a way where at the end I'm punching the air, which is like if a book makes me punch the air, that's the same, like it's getting a physical emotional reaction from mm-hmm. me in the same way did the book make me cry. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it has to make you cry, but there was nothing in this book which made me either cry or punch the air or change my mind about anything.
Yeah. So I think between the two of us, 4.5 is
good. That's what I'm saying. It's totally fine. And again, I don't want any of those to be criticisms of the book.
No.
I'm just saying for me, a 5-star book is a once a year kind of reading. And this book wasn't that.
Okay.
And also, I know it's weird to say this. I don't think Etienne Tchaikovsky is the author for me who would move me emotionally in a way.
That's not kind of his thing.
I will get again. I can still give him one of his books 5-star. No, actually, that's not true because I do think his Children of Time, Chaos, those two books.
Yeah.
I think I was moved emotionally in those books. In a way which is actually more difficult and surprising because it's talking about spiders and octopuses.
Yeah.
And that at the end of that second book where they're like, we're going on an adventure. And I'm like, holy shit. and I'm right now going, oh my goodness, don't say that we're going on an adventure. Or do say that we're whatever the payoff is.
It immediately triggers things in your brain.
Oh no, I am triggered. So maybe Children of Time, Children of Chaos, those two books together.
Okay, I understand that. But it's not again, in this realm.
Yeah, no. Not every author can do that in all of their books. And I think
they don't need to.
And I think Adrian Tchaikovsky he is capable of doing it, but that's not the reason why I read his books.
Yeah.
Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
Whereas other authors, I kind of go in knowing that they're gonna be able to push buttons to be make me punch the air in triumph at the end of the book or rewire my brain in a way which doesn't always happen. All right then. I've already said let's wrap it up. We've done the rating. Let's go over to
Goodreads.
To Goodreads.
Look, this book came out in 2024.
Yeah. It's got 7,675 ratings mm-hmm. and it's averaging out as 4.03, which again,
that's
I feel
pretty
good.
High rating.
But I look at the graph here. If you go down to the graph, I notice that the majority or the plurality of people are giving it 4 stars.
Yes.
So this is a highly rated book because everybody thinks it's about 4 stars on average. Very few 1 stars and 2 stars. But then the 5 stars, there's only 30% of people give it 5 stars. So this graph shape here
shape.
I think is telling.
Yeah.
And I agree. And for me, I agree with it.
Yeah.
And some people who are friends of mine, Diva Diane rated it 5 stars, Ziven 4 stars, B 4 stars, Lindsay 4 stars. David Brady rated it 3 stars, but then puts DNF, which means did not finish. So I don't know how you can not finish a book and still give it 3 stars, but he says didn't hate it, life's too short. James gave it 2 stars. One of the things that James says here, because I looked through some of these reviews 2 weeks ago, whenever mm-hmm. I finished the book.
Yeah.
He says, unfortunately, the book is completely written in the casual, very unliterary voice of the protagonist. I know it was intentional. I don't need prose to be flowery, but it just felt amateurish. And I do think that's it. I don't think it's amateurish. I think it's writing to a time, which is our current kind of fiction / political environment, that you can have this casual unliterary voice. It's very John Scalzi. It's very whatever. I'm not saying it is that. I'm just saying I understand why somebody would think that.
Yes.
Like they would find the voice to be unliterary. I think it's very literary, but I understand that the vibe that he's going for.
I think the book is very literary, as in the sense of what you read, like the words you use, the environment descriptions. However, of course, your main character still is this professor guy.
Yeah. What I'm trying to say is the affect in the book, let me put it that way, of the main character could be John Scalzi, but I think the everything else in the book is just 1,000 levels above what John Scalzi is. Is capable of writing. And John Scalzi is very much I'm a centrist, I'm just going to write straight down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So any of his political stuff is about, like, you know, in the those
we
books.
We don't need to get into it.
I don't know. What were they called?
No, please. No, no. Don't.
The Emperor's.
Let's not end on John Scalzi, this podcast.
I'm just saying.
I don't want that.
It's trick. I think he's tricking people into using like what on the surface level feels like the voice of an unliterary voice.
Yeah.
To bring people in. But then everything else about it is a bit more. But that's why I think this is going to date. I think this book is going to feel dated because that tone of voice as for a main character feels very like 2022 to 2024.
Okay.
But I think Adrian Tchaikovsky is clever enough that he uses that voice when he wants to write something which can trick people into feeling a bit more comfortable than is needed or than the actual.
Yeah, and he doesn't. And I think the big difference here is that he doesn't use this because everybody speaks like that.
No.
He uses that purposefully for this particular main character. There is a purpose to it. I don't think it is like just because that is how everybody does it right now and how people speak or how people are being collected from where they are. I think he does that very purposefully here.
Right then. Jason rates it 4 stars. So anyway, Among Friends, again, kind of a 4-star average too.
Yeah.
You can follow me on Instagram and Mastodon maybe and Blue
Goodreads.
Sky.
Yeah.
And what? And also become a friend of Goodreads. You get over to the Goodreads group called SFBRP Listener Group.
Yeah.
And you can recommend books there, discuss the latest episodes, give feedback and things like that. So, Adrian Tchaikovsky turns out a very good writer and got interesting ideas and stuff. And that he can, again, it's one of those things that he wrote this book and also Service Model came out in the same year. And there was like another novel. I'd probably have to look up which one it is. Yeah.
Wow.
Very impressive.
Yes.
Very impressive. Right, that's it from us. Thanks a lot for listening and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.